Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope, and thank you for joining us this week for the second episode of Season 2. All my life, my hockey number has always been 22, so the double deuces of this episode is pretty special to me. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I am not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. Thank you all so much for the love while we took some time off in between seasons and for our first episode back. It's unfortunate that Instagram went down on the first day back of Season 2, but we've seen the love since then. It's been great to see everyone asking for Season 2 and the feedback we've gotten from it so far. As I said last week, we've got such an exciting season of episodes coming your way, with more than 10 of our traditional interview formats with folks who truly have some amazing stories of fight, determination, and hope, along with bonus episodes straight from the Sip of Hope Conversations Cafe event series. Our traditional interviews will be coming at you weekly every Wednesday, just like normal, but our bonus episodes will be going live as soon as we can get them. These bonus episodes will be live podcast recordings from the Conversations Cafe events held right here in Chicago at the Sip of Hope Coffee Bar. And the very first one will be coming at you this Friday, March 22nd, just in time for C2E2, Chicago's biggest and best comics and pop culture convention. The topic of this month's event is The Hero in You, Positive Mental Health Influences in Pop Culture, with a very special guest. So tickets will be limited this go-round. Be sure to keep an eye on Hope for the Day and Sip of Hope Facebook pages, as well as the Hope for the Day's Eventbrite page once they go live in the future. If you are in Chicago and listening to the episode the day it comes out, that live event is actually happening this very night. That's right, tonight. So go check out the event pages I mentioned above and see if tickets are still available to join us at this event live. If you can't make it to the live event but are attending C2E2 this weekend, Hope for the Day will have a booth there, and we will be doing some interviews for Anthologies of Hope and Conversations Cafe, roving reporter style. So be on the lookout for us and come say hi. Picking up where we left off with our traditional episode format from last season, we are continuing our interviews with members of the HeartCamp family. If you're not familiar with HeartCamp, we dive deep into the ins and outs of it in our first two episodes of Season 1. But as a quick refresher, HeartCamp is the brainchild of Jamie Torkowski and a two-day workshop focusing on authenticity, writing, bringing your heart to work, and mental health. For more info on HeartCamp, including upcoming dates like May 4th and 5th in Melbourne, Florida, you can check out heartcampwithjamie.com for details. Also, the benefit of attending HeartCamp this go-round is you will get to meet Jamie's brand new puppy. So that should be more than enough of an incentive to go. This week, Carrie Marcella joins us from upstate New York during the most wonderful time of the year, early January. As you'll hear, it's not always the greatest during winter in that part of the country, but it's still worth it. Carrie has one tremendous story, which, similar to some of our Season 1 guests like Jen John and Jenny Gillies, she has a solid grasp of, and the work she has done on her journey shows through her storytelling. She has experienced a lot along the way, from losing a best friend to suicide, depression, anxiety, an eating disorder, and addiction, but you can see now, by the way she tells her story, that it does not wholly define her in a singular way, and she is so much more than all those individual labels put together. I hadn't connected with Carrie prior to recording this interview, so it was a blast to talk with her for this episode, and I'm grateful for her sharing her story. Moving on to our Season 2 playlist, which will be available at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, you will still be able to find Season 1 playlist under our user account on Spotify, as well as anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-1. This week, we have a spontaneous new game, which I hope makes unplanned returns in the future. Similar to Season 1 guest, Britt, Carrie is a massive Taylor Swift fan, or Swiftie for those in the know, and we end up playing a pretty fun and pretty funny guessing game for Carrie to guess Britt's selection from the Season 1 playlist. My choice for this week was a difficult one, but I ended up taking the cop-out and going with two. Both of these songs mean so much to me, and I pull out so many layers between the two that it didn't seem right to pick one and not the other. Best I Can by Art of Dying and When Legends Rise by Godsmack are two songs that I often pull lyrics from as inspiration for my writing, as well as how I form conversations both with myself and the regular kind, you know, with other people. But they both allow me to give myself grace in times when I am extra hard on myself, but also remind me that in any instance, the phoenix must go through the fire before it can be reborn. Both of these sentiments really resonated with me after recording Carrie's episode. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we will be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from To Write Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. Detroit Love in Our Arms can be found at TWLOHA.com/find-help. And Hope for the Day can be found at HFTD.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Sit back, relax, and dig into this week's episode of Anthologies of Hope, Season 2, Episode 2, Carrie Marcella.
Okay, cool. So I'm Carrie. I am from upstate New York, the Rochester area, and I went to Hard Camp last February. And yeah, I've been a huge advocate for mental health my whole life. I've been through my own things, but Hard Camp was what got me here. So
what avenues of mental health advocacy are you a part of? And I'm sure I probably in upstate New York that seasonal affective disorder is a big thing, especially yeah. there, and being, you know, right on the lake there. But what else, what kind of led you to mental health advocacy, to date, I guess?
Yeah. So a whole bunch of things. I myself, you know, am a suicide attempt survivor. I am recovering from an eating disorder, which is going awesomely. I struggle with depression, ADHD, anxiety, the whole gamut. Mm-hmm. But what another thing that kind of propelled me to move forward is that I lost my best friend, Megan, to suicide. And that kind of opened my eyes to how, not selfish, but how consumed with my own hurt that I had been, that mm-hmm. I wasn't seeing the hurt that other people were showing in front of me. So as bad as my struggles have been, I think having Megan not here helped push me forward even more.
And that ends up being, unfortunately, all too common of a case for folks who are in the mental health advocacy space to do that. One of the local organizations in Chicago, similar to Detroit Love in Our Arms, but Hope for the Day, which we mentioned, that was started out of the same thing as far as having a mentor being lost to suicide. My direction and into this entire space was having, you know, multiple friends and family lost to suicide. So unfortunately, that is the case where we end up having the kind of the veil lifted on some of that to kind of see that the larger community as a whole and the impact that it unfortunately has on the community as a whole. Why don't we just jump into some more of the background of your journey first? And
yeah,
what were some of the resources that you found along your way? I mean, you mentioned a good number of things. There's a pretty common, there's a pretty common intersect among depression, anxiety for a lot of the folks that we've talked to. And so using that as maybe a part there, why don't you just jump into some of your journey and what you used along the way to figure that out?
Yeah, so absolutely. So, and I like that you mentioned that it's all too common to have more than one thing. Mm-hmm. And when I was growing up, I was not diagnosed with ADHD until I was 19. So I went undiagnosed for a while. And it's a hard thing to kind of understand because we all have issues with attention span, or there's, you know, a portrayal in the media or in popular culture about what it is to have ADHD. So I always did really well in school. I just was bored a lot of the time, mm-hmm. which is something that I didn't associate with ADD at all. I was always getting up, going to the nurse's office. But so when I was growing up, I had a lot of shame around the energetic side of me because I couldn't sit still in class, which sounds obvious now, like, yeah, obviously she has ADD, but I had a lot of shame around who I was. And a part of my story as well is that I am gay. And again, growing up, I didn't realize it, which is a thing. So I internalized this really, really deep belief that who I am who I really truly am is not okay because it didn't fit into this norm of how I'm supposed to act or how I'm supposed to look. And that shame just kind of snowballed and snowballed. And what my therapist tells me is that I just kind of had like a perfect storm for the depression and the anxiety. So we all kind of carry our own genetic makeup and whatever. But I believe that environment also plays a factor. And it's not that my parents didn't do a good job of raising me or my teachers weren't observant enough to see that I had these issues. It's just more that it was the perfect storm. I didn't feel like I could speak up and say, this is who I am and it's okay. And so shortly after I got diagnosed with the ADHD, the depression and anxiety came afterwards. I wasn't really given a plan of how to find coping skills for those things. I was more just kind of said, okay, here you are. And I was at college and if you've been to college on a college campus, you know what it's like to kind of find yourself in a new environment where there's, you know, no parents and all that kind of stuff. But it was just a constant journey of putting on a face like, this is who I think I'm supposed to be. And I'm very ashamed of who I actually am. So I'm going to do whatever I can to numb out who I am so I can present myself in an acceptable way to the world. I used, you know, I dabbled in drugs and alcohol to kind of slow myself down. So drinking and smoking marijuana, pot, whatever you want to call it, just slowed me down to where I figured I was an acceptable human being. And that led me to some issues because I didn't mention that I played lacrosse in college. So that got me into some issues. So what I'm building up to here is that once the drugs and alcohol got taken away and I was kind of told, you know, you need to get your shit together. And sorry, I swore. You need to get your stuff.
With everything else we're talking about, swearing isn't what we got to worry about.
All right. True. I was kind of told, you know, get your shit together or you're not on this team anymore. So I internalized that to be, again, you know, you're not good enough.
Exactly.
And that's kind of when my eating disorder really started taking off. And it started this kind of like 10-year journey with the eating disorder that went, you know, it wasn't a drop-off. It was kind of like a gradual decline. I guess I just spoke way too much about all of that stuff, but I think that answered most of what you were asking. Or
no, that's a perfect answer, and it ends up getting into, it's a perfect lead into to the following question, but I mean, you're right, that's kind of the time period that you just mentioned there. It ends up being the perfect storm or a perfect confluence of all the different types of nature, nurture, environment, all the other things there, as far as growing up and the, you know, the timing that you said you were diagnosed with ADHD, but then also going to college where many people are on their own for the first time. And it's also in common society, common Western culture, where you go to college, you find yourself, and that's, you know, who you are for the rest of your life. So there's a lot of implicit pressure on that to kind of do it right the first time and meet people that, you know, you'll be around forever.
Yeah.
Or you'll want to be around forever. Mm-hmm. And then again, not even including in that the pressure of playing a sport at the university level.
Yeah.
And then
absolutely,
and just having all of that again, yes, snowball, which is not surprising in any way, shape, or form. Now, through all of that, did you seek any sort of counseling help or therapy help, or was there anything you were doing that instead of just the negative coping mechanisms that you mentioned, was there any kind of positive aspects that you maybe tried but just didn't succeed with or have a good experience with from the mental health side of things?
Yeah. So, again, when I went to undergrad, I went to a counselor on campus. It was part of my agreement with my coach to get back on the team. And it was a weird experience because I didn't really want to change. I just wanted to be back on the team because another big part of my story that I'd like to talk about too is how I mean, I have parents that love me, and I had a lot of friends who also loved and still love me. And I think that that's something that makes it even harder to ask for help, because I would sit and think, there are people in the, and you're told, we're told a lot, like, there are people in this world that have it so much worse than you. People that don't have parents, people that don't have a roof over their heads, people mm-hmm. that don't have the means to be a quote unquote successful person. And so I had a hard time accepting that I needed more help than just someone saying, you know, go get them, Carrie. I needed professional help. So when I first tried the counselor in college, I wasn't open to it. The woman, I really don't recall how helpful or not helpful she was. I just know that I wasn't into it. So that was my first attempt at seeing counseling, but I more so did it just because I was told to. At that time, I also tried to go to some 12-step recovery, you know, meetings in the college town that I was at, which was a nice place to start for something. Mm-hmm. But
most of that stuff usually ends up being additive or kind of complementary to it. So you're generally not having one thing that is, you know, the magical resolution where it's, you know, the one band-aid or medication that's going to fix everything. But yeah, going into all of those things together generally tends to help a little bit better. But as you were mentioning, that everything was snowballing in a perfect storm there. So probably needing to go through everything together was something that would be a little bit more fruitful or effective in the long run, as opposed to again, yeah, like somebody saying, like, just go get them, and having the positive backing and have that be miraculously the end all be all piece there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't drinking or using drugs, which was the goal at that time, right? Because that was, you know, what had gotten me in trouble. And in the background, the eating disorder was just brewing and brewing and brewing. And I was in such deep denial by the time I went to grad school that I don't really recall much of grad school. Mm-hmm. I also I moved back home. I went to college not far away from here, and I moved back home to go to grad school and commuted from there. So I was living at my parents' house, and that was kind of like the bottom where I was at when I was in grad school. It was around like 2009.
Okay.
And by that time I had found To Write Love on Her Arms, which was awesome because people online on MySpace, and which is always funny to me to talk about MySpace, like it's an antiquated thing, like, yeah. MySpace. Oh my gosh, it's so old.
The Rosetta Stone.
Right. But I just remember sitting in my parents' house and seeing people online talking about things, because the things that I felt I was ashamed of, or feeling like, yes, I was sad, but again, I had parents that loved me. I had a means to have a successful, happy life, and I was miserable, and mm-hmm. people were talking about things and being honest and open. And it was really cool thing to see. And it was cool too, because it was kind of, I mean, I think that most people, especially if they're listening to this podcast, know that the culture that surrounds To Write Love on Her Arms is really awesome as well. You'll see them at concerts. It was more than just, here is a resource. It is run by adults who have a degree, who are medical professionals. This was more of like a community type of thing. So that was my first dive into that. And I'll fast forward a little bit because it's more of the same, but I like what you said about it being it's never just one thing that can help us get better, get to where we're going. So I've seen the same therapist for the last 7 years. Okay. And I joke with everyone that I see her at least once every other week, and it's the longest relationship I've ever had. And I adore this woman. If you are in my life, you know, Michelle with 1L, the therapist, is one of my favorite and one of my least favorite people in the world. But I also go to group therapy, I have friends that just the other day called someone up and was just crying for no reason, just cry, you know? So I have people that now I know that I don't need to be ashamed of those things that I've been through. So I hope that kind of covered what you were asking.
No, absolutely. It ends up being a case where you're not the only person that we've talked to for the podcast or just in the Hartkamp family or, you know, casually or whatever, who have basically said that exact same line where, you know, the longest relationship they've had is with their therapist for better or worse, but it's the one that's helped them out the most. So, you know, you take what you can from it. But one of the other pieces that you mentioned there, and I was just having this conversation with Amanda and then we recorded an episode the other day where the biggest change kind of, and that's where I didn't want to be presumptuous and, assume timing of when you were in school or anything. So I'm glad you mentioned when you were in grad school and some of those other times, because it fits with the timeline that I talk about here. But it's a case where the biggest thing in the change of kind of trait love has been able to ride the wave of has been the notion of proliferation of smartphones and app culture and things like that, where we're lowering the barrier of entry to that level of help. Because prior to that, like you were saying, you had supportive parents, you had supportive family, but who wants to go to them? And when they've done everything else for you and basically your brain is telling you I'm broken, and that is then you condemning your parents for how they raised you. Whereas now, it's not like you have to circumvent it, but before you kind of had to go through those routes. Whereas now there's many more avenues to get to even, you know, first level help or just kind of just to talk through it with folks that, you know, you don't need to have those immediate friends to do it, where again, you don't want to burden your friends right away, but you can still seek professional help through things like Talkspace, crisis text line, National Suicide Prevention Hotline, things like that, where you're able to reach out to folks. And it's a matter of both access to those platforms and knowledge of those platforms that have changed probably over the last 10, 12 years, which is great to have that, because it ends up being a case where you're no longer sticking inside your own head and punishing yourself because you don't want to put, you know, the blame on your parents, where again, these things are, as much as we call it mental health, they are physical conditions that manifest in the brain that no matter where you're at, that's going to happen. So again, lowering that bar to access to all of the resources, all of the availability of that stuff, while at the same time still making it known it's accessible and you can still talk about it in the other avenues that you normally would, has been, you know, beneficial over the past decade with the growth of the kind of proliferation of information as well. So that's been a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that. And I like that there are so many different avenues now. And I think the biggest change for me in all of this has been seeing that I am not the only person that goes through these things. And I'm not the only person that will ever go through these things alone. I actually remember growing up, and a big part of my story, like I said, too, something that seems irrelevant to me now is the fact that I'm gay. And I remember thinking, I think the show was Ricky Lake, maybe. I remember thinking I am some kind of freak, not because of, so the way that I present myself to the world is, and I work with kids now and they're so funny because they're like, you're a boy. And I'm like, no, you know, I'm not. And that's my truth. And that's my story. There are people that, you know, maybe were born a woman and want to be a boy, but that's not my story. You know, I don't say that to the kids, but the way that I present myself is very athletic, very not super feminine, but I thought that I belonged on Ricky Lake, like girl dressed as boy. That was how I thought I was the only person in the world who had these issues or these thoughts or these feelings of, yeah, people get sad, but I'm sad and I can't even tell you the reason why, or why do I have so much energy? And learning that I'm not the only person that goes through these things or that thinks these things makes it easier for me to be the only me in the world, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. And that's, again, the whole point of this podcast and the stories that we're sharing here is to keep that now positive snowball effect going, where it is the exactly what you just said. Like, you didn't know you weren't the only one going through that because you never heard somebody else talk about it. So having access to these resources, having in print, video, audio, you know, seeing organizations at concerts and music festivals and things like that, it opens up your eyes, and your first step is it immediately lifts some of that burden off your shoulders. It doesn't feel like the entire world sitting on your back, but then you know that there are other people out there. You can start to now do some of your own investigation, some of your own communication, and dig into that, where now you eventually digging in, you would understand or come to know that, you know, Ricky Lake isn't the place for you, using that, that metaphor.
Right.
But it's something where there's many other avenues of folks that you can talk to who are dealing with the same thing, who have gone through it, who have resources, and, you know, can point you in those directions to understand what exactly is your truth and how to get to it, and what do you want to do with it once you find it or once you're on that path.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think we all, biggest need that all of us as human beings have is that connection. And that's what my mental illnesses always felt like, a disconnection, that I wasn't worthy of love of any sort. I wasn't worthy of the space that I took up. It's funny, when I talk to other people who are recovering from eating disorders, we talk a lot about, I always felt like I was in the way. So a metaphor that we sometimes use is like, I just wanted to take up as little physical space as possible, because that's how worthy I felt of people's time, of people's love, of people's attention. And it's crazy, because sometimes just that little bit of connection to get you through those moments where you feel like you won't get through it is all we need. Like I said, a few days ago, I was just crying for no reason. And my girlfriend came over with a chocolate milkshake and a hug before she went home. And it was so and I still, you know, I cried after that too, because it was so sweet, but it didn't take all of the pain away. But in that moment, it made it not feel like the end of the world.
Exactly. And that goes back to some of what we were talking about before, as all of those different elements of treatment, but also just elements of existence, where, again, and something that I've taken a while to learn, and Amanda as well, where it's a case where not everything needs to be fixed, but you can just, you know, exist. And that is very similar to that, where the experience there with the milkshake and the hug, where you don't need that problem to go away. You just want to exist, be known, and sit in that space. And then, okay, I can deal with the rest of it later. It's just right now that was too heavy, and now I can kind of come back down and level it out. And that's all I really needed in that moment. So that's a good story, where very similarly, watching a heavy metal concert video yesterday on the couch, and they brought up a couple of celebrities that we've lost to suicide in the past 18 months-ish. And by the end of the song, I was just, you know, crying on the couch, and it wasn't anything that I needed to be done or there, but it was just kind of, you know, existing in that moment and giving myself the ability to feel while sitting there. So that was very similar. So I'm not a stranger to some of those situations there.
Yeah, I like that. And it's even comforting to hear that that's not a thing that we experience alone. You know, I think that those of us that struggle with any type of mental illness have a hard time explaining to people who don't struggle what it's like. And I think that each person's experience is unique, though, like, it's all connected by some common thread. It's unique in that a lot of the times when my depression is heavy, I don't have a reason. So when, you know, my girlfriend or my brother asks me, what's wrong? What happened? Nothing. I just feel sad. And the more that I try to look for something, the more that distorted reality comes into play, where, okay, now I'm going to look for something, and then I'm going to be even more upset. So again, like you said, just existing and the most important question that anyone can ask me when I'm struggling, which I try to ask other people when they're struggling, is how can I help? Mm-hmm. Because if you can voice that, if you can say, this is what I need, or if you can even say, I don't know what I need, then it takes away that shame of, I feel this way and I don't know why. We always want an answer as to why we feel some way, but sometimes, like you said, we just need that space to feel those things, because for 90% of my life, I ran from any feeling. So crying the other day, I guess, was what I needed. I didn't need a reason. It just needed to happen.
Yeah. And I like what you were saying there. Some of the, and it coincides 100% with some of the training I've done with Hope for the Day for proactive suicide prevention and mm-hmm. essentially dealing with mental health crises. But it's a case of ask what questions, not why questions. So yeah. If you can dig into the what and just come around to the reality of whomever you're talking to, it ends up being a case where you're allowing them to speak to their existence, speak to their reality, speak to their own agency, as opposed to using why, which ends up, you know, stigmatizing it. And
yeah,
just like you're saying here, 98% of the time, we have no idea why the hell it is why. It's just, we know mm-hmm. what it is, and that's the only thing we can explain. And yeah. So that ends up being a kind of tool there to frame conversations in and understand the what, not why piece. And then that ends up being so much more helpful than trying to, you know, pinpoint something and then flick a switch to say, oh, okay, well now we fixed that and now everything's fine. So just again, right. just the identifying the why can go a long way.
Right. Yeah. It's like if what some, my therapist and I will joke, like what is wrong? What's wrong? Why are you crying? What's wrong? She'll be like, what do they expect you to say? Like, years of neglect and abuse, that one time in third grade where I forgot, you know, extra shoes and ran through the mud. I don't know what's wrong. I'm just crying.
Like, yep, exactly.
So it's, you're right. What's wrong? I mean, I don't know. Do you have a couple hours? but the growth through and being able to joke and laugh about that is good. It's
yeah. Again, that shows growth, that shows strength and progress at least. So that's a good start.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why don't we pivot? Was there anything else you wanted to touch on your journey before we dive a little bit deeper into Trite Love and Heart Camp and that path, or was that?
Yeah, no, that sounds great. I've enjoyed it so far. Okay. So
yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned Trite Love and coming into contact with them on the ancient artifact known as MySpace. So, I mean, how did you end up hearing about Heart Camp? I mean, what was your interaction with Trite Love between, you know, finding them and early last year when Jamie started talking about Heart Camp and stuff like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I first heard of To Write Love at a concert and saw the shirt, the Love is the Movement shirt. And I just thought that was such a cool phrase. I had no idea. I was really sick at the time. No idea what it meant or anything, but looked it up and did that. So my involvement over the years has been wearing those shirts that start those conversations, mm-hmm. talking about it, when sharing my story with people, because people on MySpace inspired me by doing the same thing. And, you know, I'm a big believer too in just needing a moment to separate reality from the distorted thing that my darkness tries to tell me. Mm-hmm. And To Write Love does such a good job of that. So yeah, every year at Warped Tour, I would go and talk to the people at the booth there, kind of share stories with them, which was always exciting. All through that, I went to Heavy and Light. So I'm from upstate New York. I went to Heavy and Light 2 years ago, just by myself. It was...
Was that 2016 or 2017?
It wasn't... It was 2017. Okay. Yep. So I went there, and it was the first time a lot of my life I spent waiting for someone else to say, yeah, let's do that. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what propelled me to just be like, screw it. I'm going to Florida by myself and I'm going to Heavy and Light. And that is what I did. And it was really, really, really cool. I mean, if you've ever been to Heavy and Light, or if anyone listening has been, it's a really cool experience. And there are so many people who did and do the same thing as me. Like, I've stood next to a girl at Heavy and Light that was like, I'm afraid of traveling alone. And here I am. And I was like, wow, this is powerful. So with the Heart Camp thing, I actually, after I went to Heavy and Light, I booked a week-long trip to Phoenix, Arizona, because, I mean, you talked about in the very beginning, seasonal affect disorder. And this time of year is the worst for me. And it's not even just the weather. It's just the dark up here and all that. And
not too different in Chicago, where it's pitch black by 4:30 and then you're inundated with it for a couple hours. And you're like, holy shit, I need to go to bed. But it's 6:30. And so, yeah, I being even a little further north there, I definitely get that.
Yeah. So I went to Phoenix and did that solo trip, and I had finally gotten to a place where I had saved up money from having like a consistent job, because I was unemployed for a long time. So I had saved up enough money, and this is going to sound really lame, but I was going to buy pit tickets to see Taylor Swift in Toronto. I'm a huge Taylor Swift fan, and I don't, you know, get mad if other people don't like her. Again, I've learned that it's fine. What I like is what I like. And if you don't like it, more for me.
Exactly.
And the same goes for other things. You know, like a lot of people in my life like to watch football. I don't really care about football at all, but like, I love when people are passionate about things. So I hope that, you know, people can at least understand that when I say I was going to drop $2,000 on one pit ticket to see Taylor Swift, that people are like, oh, you must really like, and I don't remember what it was. Oh, I was like, the first Heart Camp had passed and sold out. And the day that I was going to buy the Taylor Swift ticket, Jamie announced that he was going to hold a second Heart Camp.
Okay.
And it was one of those, like, you know, moments where you're like, oh, because I thought it was so cool to be able to, you know, spend some time doing something instead of just going on a trip. So spend some time working on myself and being able to bring that advocacy to a different level than I was already doing. And instead of using that money to go see Taylor Swift, I made the decision that night to sign up for Heart Camp, which
That's
was
awesome.
Really cool. Yeah, it was cool. So, I mean, there were a lot of other factors that played into not going to Taylor Swift. I love going to concerts by myself, but I don't think it would have been super fun to go see her by myself. Mm-hmm. So, but regardless, it was one of the best decisions I've made to spend that money on Heart Camp instead. So
we've had a lot of cool stories so far of how folks have made it to Heart Camp, even a handful of folks getting sponsored by other folks. But
yeah,
so far that one, I think for me takes the cake as far as the best one there is what made the decision to go, and the transformation from, as someone else who loves concerts and is willing to spend and has actually spent multiple packages, enhanced experience packages for Metallica shows and things like that, of having the money in hand to be like, yeah, I'm going to be front row and it's going to be awesome, to like having that experience open up before your eyes and be like, no, this is really where I should be going, and this is what's speaking to me. So as much as I'd love to be there, this is where I need to get to. So that's, I love that.
Yeah. And what was crazy about it too, is that when I say that I had saved up enough money, I held a job down and the worst part about mental illness for me sometimes is how it makes you believe that you are not worthy of anything. So I know now that I'm a very intelligent person, like very intelligent. I can pick something up and learn it if you give me a little bit of time to figure it out. And I like that about myself, but I never had an internship in college. I have an undergrad degree in something totally different than my grad degree is in, and I'm using neither of those degrees. Yeah. So when I found my place at summer camp, working at a summer camp, at a YMCA summer camp, overnight camp. And I remember Terry was on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she is a camp person as well. And she was at my heart camp session. So it was cool to have another camp person. Yeah. But so shout out to Terry. But what was crazy about the timing of heart camp was that after I had paid for the space, you know, to be reserved to go to heart camp and gotten the plane tickets, it was shortly after that that I got fired from the place that I thought I was going to stay at for a long time. Like, I was like team YMCA. I drank the Kool-Aid. I was like, yes, YMCA. And I was working a minimum wage job, and I could go into deeper detail about how stupid and fucking ridiculous it was that I got fired. But I knew that even though I'd lost that job, I still had to go to heart camp. And so it scared me. It scared me to be like, oh my gosh, I don't have a job anymore. But I was like, well, I can't cancel this heart camp thing. I can't do that. So even just that force of knowing that I was supposed to be down there, and I will never forget the feeling of this moment. I think we remember moments a lot and there's like a memory of it there, but I will never forget the feeling of that moment when we are at the very first session, you know, and when we're at heart camp, we sat in tables with people who kind of lived near where we live. Mm-hmm. So the very first question that Jamie asked was, and you know, I'd never met these people. I was sitting next to a girl named Julie, who's from Toronto, which is about 3-4 hours away from where I live. And the first question Jamie asks is, do you get to bring your heart to work? And it took everything in me to not run out of that room, yeah, burst into tears. And I knew I had made the right decision to not cancel the trip when this girl, Julie, who I had never met before, kind of took my hand and saw that I was holding back tears. And she was like, it's okay. It's okay. And I'm going to start crying now, but it was one of those moments where I was like, yes, this was where I was supposed to be.
Again, and that's the other tagline for Heart Camp, is that your heart is welcome there. And that's mm-hmm. the exact reason that you needed to be there. So you may have had a situation like that at Taylor Swift, but the fact that, right, that you were there,
right,
where you needed to be, and you know, that experience and the kind of the serendipity of where you were placed table wise and things like uh-huh. that kind of made it all. And I would, it sounds like it was a very affirming experience for you to tell you that was exactly where you needed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. So most of us had experiences like that where we were like, yeah, this is what I needed to be doing.
That's excellent. Yeah, I'm glad that that was a very affirming and positive experience initially, even right from the get-go, to make sure that that's where you were. Because obviously, with that type of initial engagement, if that hadn't happened, you could have been, you know, standoffish for some of it and still, as you were saying, like afraid to share. But with there, I can imagine you're all in once that happens and even, you know, gung-ho for everything for the rest of the 2 days. So that's an awesome way, and again, probably the best way I've heard so far of kicking off heart camp. So that's a great one.
Yeah, it was cool. I and it gave me permission to say, hey, I just lost a job that I thought I cared a whole lot about. And the sad part about that whole job that I stayed in for years, and I should have moved on years ago, but I wanted so badly for them to see my heart and for them to see my passion. Mm-hmm. And they just, I mean, 90% of people, I'm sure, have had experiences with bosses who just don't want you to succeed and want you to stay down on the ground where they think you belong because they're intimidated by the power of your heart. And they know that they don't, for some reason, let their heart show itself in its entirety. So that question, again, like you said, it was very affirming and allowed me to share and just start the whole experience off for myself and maybe for others, that it's okay to cry here. So
yeah, well, that, and then again, being in a period of transition is exactly where it's also meant to be. So the fact where you're not 100% sure about where you're going, what does that mean? And you know, what it speaks to you for being in a place you thought you wanted to be, or you thought that, you know, had your heart, and then now it was kind of discarded. So the transition and then being authentic and having your heart and taking it to work and stuff like that, that's the more you say it, it's clear why you chose Heart Camp over Taylor Swift. So that ends up being the case there, where it makes it all too I'm all too grateful that you actually did end up there, and that we're having this conversation now.
Yes, me too. Absolutely.
Was there anything else on Heart Camp that you wanted to touch on before we, you know, start to come to the back third of some of this stuff?
I don't think so. I think that it was, you know, again, being in a space where it's okay to be yourself in front of strangers. It reminds me sometimes of going to, it's so much easier for us sometimes to be ourselves in a place where no one knows us. Mm-hmm. But what was extra cool about Heart Camp is, you know, the connections that we have. I got a Facebook message from one of the participants, you know, just out of the blue, saying, "Hey, I know we didn't really talk to each other, you know, talk much at Heart Camp or since, but I just wanted to let you know that you're valued." And so it's that added cool factor of staying connected even after Heart Camp is over. So we got to be ourselves in that space, and we get to continue to be ourselves and have these really cool connections with people from all over, which was an amazing thing that I would pay money for again and again and again and again.
Yeah, and agreed. That's been one of the amazing things, and again, the genesis of this podcast, but having the ability to connect after Heart Camp. And there's, you know, a number of other types of seminars and workshops and things, but those you generally don't end up staying as connected. So I think it ended up being a case where a lot of folks having the background with To Write Love, but then also going in with similar intentions and knowing that it's a shared safe space to come in with, again, everything that you said, many of the different folks kind of bring in and are working with, but also the way Jamie couched it for your heart being welcome here, and then bringing your heart to work, authenticity, writing, nonprofits, all the different pieces there. It ends up being a case where that is a lot of kindling for the fire that later on can kind of burn bright after the sessions, and even, you know, cross pollination between the different groups and all of that stuff. So that's, to me, that's been similar. One of the most beautiful parts of having all of those friendships and relationships blossom afterwards as well.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. I think that that's a cool thing. Like I said before, I think that our deepest need and desire is that level of connection. And it's more than just I'm an expert at having surface level relationships, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, I'm for the first time in a long-term romantic relationship. And that is the scariest shit I have ever done in my life, because I can have a very surface level relationship with anybody, which is good. And it's nice. I like that I'm personable and bubbly and energetic, but I didn't realize how scary it is to let someone be that close. Yep. And I experienced that at Heart Camp as well. You know, the intimacy of friendships, it's what we all want, but at the same time, I think it's so unfamiliar to us that we just, I don't know, run from it sometimes. So anything that draws me closer to connection with anyone is awesome. A thing that, again, I've had to learn through, before Heart Camp, I have one friend, one mentor who is, I don't know if I would still be here without her. She is amazing. I spend Christmas and Thanksgiving with her family. But one of the hardest things for me to learn was A, just because I think something is funny doesn't mean other people think it's funny. Like when I, you know, as a 30-year-old steal my best friend's phone and think it's funny and she goes, no, that's not funny. I'm like, yeah, it's funny. I'm doing it. So it's obviously funny. But so I'd be interested to see, you know, the interactions with different types of people, because when I am struggling, and she has her own mental health struggles as well, which is why we're so close. When I'm struggling, I need connection and I need to talk to people that I trust or people that can be there for me, at least physically, give me a hug, bring me a milkshake. And when she is struggling, she needs me to leave her the frick alone. And that was always, that was hard for me to comprehend until I thought that it meant that she hated me and wanted me to go to hell, but turns out, nope, she loves me just the same. And that's just her way of dealing with things, which is a cool thing to kind of learn and navigate. So I'll be interested to see more about that with that. So thank you.
Hearing some of your backstory and hearing the college athlete and some of that stuff, I'm interested to hear some of the other parts of what you have to say here. But what are some of your favorite forms of self-care aside from, as you mentioned, the quality of your therapist relationship? Mm-hmm. But to me, having a lot of experience with sports throughout my life, that's always been, you know, physical activity has been one major form of that. But then what are some of the other, if physical activity or otherwise, for some of your self-care?
Yeah. So my eating disorder took the form of working out. Okay. So what self-care means to me is, and when I was recovering, when I first started recovery, I had a nutritionist, Michelle with 1L, and a personal trainer who wasn't training me. He was teaching me how to work out without it being disordered.
Yep.
So working out is still probably my biggest form of self-care. But that also means if I am not feeling a workout, listening to my body, which has been weird thing to learn, because for so long I didn't want to listen to my body. So self-care is that.
But it's also, not to interrupt you, but it's also interesting timing as far as when we're recording this, in between Christmas and New Year's, when everybody is making those New Year's resolutions to get back into the gym, et cetera, et cetera. And so for them, working out tends to be, when you're looking at it, it's a destructive method to kind of reduce what's there. Whereas in what you're saying there, it's more of a constructive or proactive method to build yourself and to build strength, as opposed to just kind of cut away something that may be there. So I'm glad you mentioned the kind of the team you have there to understand the different types of workouts there that make sense and what is going to be a positive workout versus something that could have negative side effects.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that as much of an advocate that I am for connection, you know, person to person, I also can't stress enough the importance of professional help. So, and for me, that meant not just Michelle, but it meant a nutritionist telling me exactly what to eat and then wondering why I wasn't listening to her, and a personal trainer telling me, it's putting that trust in other people because they are professionals. Yep. So it's a balance between having people in your life, whether it's through an organization to like to write love on our arms or from Heart Camp, that aren't professionals and that can be there to offer that support. And then on the other end of that is that professional support of people who have a credential. It's not just someone who's saying, I've been through this before, you're going to be okay. It's someone saying, these are exactly how many calories you need. You're not going to, it's a shift in the thinking, the destructive thinking that, you know, my brain is just wired to do. So self-care is that. It's playing the guitar, it's writing music, it's spending time with people, it's listening to music, going to concerts. I there's so many different forms of self-care that I think are so good, and some I do more than others. And what's cool too about recovering from an eating disorder is you get to kind of find yourself again. So my eating disorder and my depression and all these other things, and I normally just refer to that whole thing as my darkness or my disease, it took everything away from me. So playing guitar has always been a huge part of my life, and writing songs used to be a huge part of my life, and I didn't do it for the entire time that I was sick. So I'm always grateful when I can sit down with my guitar, and you know, it's not like I want to release a record or anything, but it's just something that's very soothing for me doing that. So
agreed. It's cathartic, and it is what you want to do and how you express yourself artistically. So it's able to, you're finally able to rediscover that and, you know, touch on areas that you may have gotten to before, but now it's kind of like rediscovering for the first time. So yeah, that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, saying, you know, figuring out what you like and what you don't like. And my girlfriend likes to cook. So figuring out that I can eat, I can eat ice cream cake and chicken parm and still not gain weight is a really cool form of self-care. It's just kind of learning by doing and giving myself permission to try things. A lot of different forms of self-care that I enjoy.
Yeah, I love that. When on Christmas Day, Amanda and I recorded her interview, and that was her biggest thing was she read a quote, I forget from which publication, but it ends up going mostly that, you know, all self-care isn't just champagne and bubble baths and things like that. So
yeah,
there's a lot of very much constructive self-care as opposed to just what is generally thought of that. So that's a great way to kind of couch that. And I'm glad you have quite the spectrum of activities there to kind of contribute to that.
Yeah. Yeah. My brain moves fast and it needs constant stimulation. So, which is not a bad thing I've learned, but channel any way I can channel that is a good thing.
Yeah. Same here, which is good for me and bad for me when I take time off for the holidays and plan to have downtime. But then during that downtime, I constantly want to be doing something. So it's constantly juggling that back and forth as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you're, you know, an advocate for personal connection. So one of the other aspects of that or kind of another way you could look at that through another lens of the prism would be community. So what does community at large, especially being a former camp person, what does community in general mean to you?
Community is probably the most important part of my life. No matter where I go, I want to feel connected, but also connected in general to a bigger thing. So I mentioned earlier in the podcast, my best friend, Megan, who I lost to suicide, and her parents, after she passed, started this organization. And what is cool about it is that the money that we raise through a golf tournament that we do every year is given right back to our community. So that makes me think about community in the larger sense of there are so many different types of people that struggle with these things that it makes me feel more connected to a larger community. So I like the idea of, like, here I am in the middle of a circle. On the very, you know, next ring is my closest friends and my family. And then as it goes farther out, it's a larger and larger community, but I still like to feel connected in that way to anything that shows me that I'm not alone and that I don't exist in a vacuum. So things that I also do, you know, in the same way that something that someone says might open my eyes to seeing something a different way or getting through those hard moments, that something maybe that I say or do can be that way for someone else.
Vice versa, and it's,
so I think, I don't know if that answers the question, but 'cause I think community for me is, I have so many different forms of community that it's hard to say, but I like the thought of a community that can't exist. You can't exist on an island.
Nope, exactly. And you nailed it with it's the most important part of life, and it helps you feel connected to something bigger. And so All of those things together with both concentric or overlapping kind of Venn diagram-y circles tend to do that, where again, having many different types of community surrounded by you and things like that ends up going a long way. But before we move away from that, what is the name of the nonprofit organization, if you don't mind sharing?
No, yeah, absolutely. It's called Meg's Gift. So what they do is raise money for people here in the Rochester community. And Megan was the nicest, prettiest, most caring individual. And the reason why they called it Meg's Gift is because her gift was just her smile that she had to offer the world. Mm-hmm. And she never felt like she could talk about her struggles with depression because, you know, she didn't want to burden other people. So it's a very, very cool organization that was built out of a lot of hurt and pain. So
it's unfortunate that it had to be formed the way it was, but we've become exposed or become aware of, I should say, a number of similar organizations, even in the Chicago area and just nationwide, that it's the kind of trying to make the most out of that pain and loss and to bring that knowledge and awareness to others through very similar activities and very similar nonprofits. So that's one we'll definitely start following and kind of keep an eye out on.
Cool. I like that. Thank you. It's crazy because part of what I have grappled with when grieving the loss of Megan is that I grew up with her. Her parents live, you know, a fourth of a mile down the road from my parents, and we played lacrosse together. We were really good friends, and I struggled a lot because I felt guilty that she lost her battle and I was still fighting mine. And we both knew that we were struggling, but neither one of us wanted to burden the other one. And I struggled with, you know, why did she lose her battle? She had a fiance, a full-time job, you know, nieces, nephews, you name it. And I was just over here unemployed. And when I take a step back and look at the bigger community, the bigger picture, I see that my parents, even though they're good people, they would not have been capable to start an organization. If that makes sense without sounding too morbid, they wouldn't have been able to do what Megan's parents have done. So although I can't comprehend why, I don't think it's my place to have to comprehend why.
Yeah, exactly. So, I'd agree completely. And that's something where being in that space, it's not something you have to feel guilty of for who won the battle or lost the battle, right, or something like that. And then again, that's also another part of the brain that we don't necessarily even need to go into as far as all the possible permutations, combinations of what could, if, and else happen type thing. It's just like, no, like, again, we just kind of bring it back to reality, bring it back here and not worry about the what ifs and what could type thing. Yeah. So those are, you know, the situations we're in now and making the most out of what we have and making the most out of our voices that we do have is the kind of the best way to kind of frame that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's been cool to watch this organization grow. And each year they pick a new charity to donate the money that they raise through the golf tournament and silent auction. And it's cool to see these things happening.
We'll start to wrap up with our two questions. And there are our normal two questions that we've had for all the episodes so far. Mm-hmm. What is one thing you'd want someone to take away from your story?
That mental illness doesn't discriminate. I want that message to be extremely loud because I think that on television, in media, at school, in my opinion, we don't teach, or at least to my knowledge, we don't teach mental illness the right way. I mean, we're so absorbed with the shock factor. And yes, there are people that are homeless that spend the little money that they have on drugs and alcohol, and they struggle with mental illness, or parents, they have one parent, they have divorced parents, they have no parents, they have a child of their own, all these circumstances that most certainly are valid and painful and horrible and worthy of attention, but that makes it harder for people like Megan or like myself who have two loving parents who did and do the best that they can and, you know, go to school and go to college and get an education and have all these things that we are supposed to have in order to be happy. The one thing that I want people to take away from any story is that I tell is that there's not just one type of person. And the worst thing that you can possibly say to someone that tells you, I think that I, you know, I'm struggling with depression is to tell them not to be sad because mm-hmm. other people have it worse. One of the most powerful things that somebody, probably Michelle with 1L, said to me is that if you tell someone not to be sad or upset because there are tons of people that have it worse than you, it's like telling them not to be happy because other people have it better than you.
Yeah.
So,
which is often that, a force multiplier because you're like, oh, well, holy shit, I am sad because other people, but other people have it worse than me. So now I'm even more sad because of that. And it just, it's the complete opposite thing to do.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. We need to consider each person's own experience with pain and as valid. And there are times even now when I have all these things in place that help me be better that I question everything, and recovery is not linear. And yeah, so I think to take pride in your story, no matter what parts are there, how many chapters are there, how many books you have to reference, the story that you have, that I have, is mine. And that is what makes it worth keeping going.
That's beautiful. And I love every aspect of that between, you know, mental illness not discriminating and then recovery not being linear, where, and taking pride in your own story, because those are all aspects that have been intimated either almost verbatim across our other conversations here, which again is perfect for folks sharing the Heart Camp community space, but then also just one where it is something that needs to be said over and over again, because it's not like you can pick mental illness out of a lineup type thing. So those are the the ways where it does not discriminate across the board, and it's something that we need to be more conscious of. And again, just sharing your story ends up helping kind of break down some of those stigmas and biases and things like that. So
absolutely.
Moving on to our last question, and hearing how you almost didn't make it to Heart Camp, I'm very interested to your answer here. Mm-hmm. What would be your one song that you'd want to share about your story? Did you listen to Britt's episode?
I didn't. I have not listened to that one yet. Okay. No, because so I want. Yeah.
She chose a Taylor Swift song.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was interested in, if based on her unabashed Swiftiness. I didn't know if you guys connected during your session, but that's what she did choose one. So we haven't had any duplicates yet. So depending on I didn't know if you ended up with one in mind, but based on her entire catalog, it's unlikely to do that. But if you would choose the same one off the top of your head, it'd be amazing. But yeah, so she chose a Taylor Swift song, but would there be one song that you'd want to share about your story, which will add to the podcast playlist on Spotify?
Yeah, so it's funny because Taylor Swift is my go-to for a lot of things, and she is putting out her Reputation tour movie on New Year's Eve, so I'm really excited. Those are my New Year's plans,
nice,
in case anyone wants to know. Watching that. But whenever it comes to choosing my top five essential tracks, her songs probably aren't on it, even though I love them. But I grew up, you know, listening to pop punk, and that is forever what will make the difference for me. So I will say that the song that most defines my story is, I know, Underrated by The Rocket Summer. If you've never heard it, it's a really good one. I actually have part of it taped up next to my bed just to remind me on days that it's hard, that a lot of times what I'm feeling is my disease talking and not reality. So
excellent. Yeah, that's one. I don't know that specific song by name. I've listened to a lot of Rocket Summer, probably a lot more over the past couple of years.
Yeah, he's great.
So that's definitely one I'll check out. Someone coming up with a heavy metal, hard rock, pop punk background, I'm always happy to add some more of that stuff, because for me that's always my catharsis, is the hard heavy hitting stuff as opposed to just the more pop ballad. So I'm always happy to get some more energy into it that way.
Yes, I like that. Yeah. Oh, now I want to guess what song she chose. Can you give me, is it a recent song or an older song?
It's an older song. Oh, I love this game now. This is fun.
Oh, I'm excited.
It's a one word title.
Oh my God. Fearless?
No.
Damn it.
Shorter word.
Mine?
Longer word.
Damn it. Oh my God. What the heck? Jesus. Yep. I'm drawing a blank.
Let me see if I can figure out which album it's on.
Oh my God.
It's on the Fearless album.
Oh. Ours?
Nope.
What the hell?
She chose Change.
Oh my gosh. My brain was stuck on The Best Day. Like, I just figured for some reason. Wow. So sorry there. That's funny. Taylor has really good songs.
Yeah, she chose that one for the verse where that starts out, "So we've been outnumbered, raided, and now cornered," and that ends up, "But there's something in your eyes that says we can beat this." So that was her choice for Taylor Swift song.
Okay, I like that. I was going to guess Innocent too. That one's a really powerful song for me all the time. So I like that one.
And that's me showing a lot of my ignorance of her song catalog, not knowing how many songs she has that are single word titles that didn't really narrow it down for you. So,
well, I wasn't expecting a curveball, like a not super popular song, okay. But Change is a really, really good song. So I like it.
Awesome.
Cool.
Excellent.
Very cool.
So yeah, this has been a home run for me. I'm so excited we could make it work.
Absolutely.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.